Hello there, it's the PC Gamer Show for September 20th, 2017. I'm Evan Lotti, Editor-in-Chief, and I'm joined by James Davenport. James, how are you doing?
Good. I mean, I wish I was better. I'm tired. We were on a trip to New York.
We just flew back from New York really late last night. You probably got home at like 1 o'clock or something silly.
Yeah, it was a late night. Also, still a little gravelly in the voice, so apologies if I get a little coffee again, but I will recover. I have antibiotics, everyone. I'm not going to die. Cross my fingers.
Bronchitis is a serious disease.
It's awful.
Visit your doctor today.
Yeah,
I also don't want to ignore the 1080p Tyler Wilde beside me here. Hi, Tyler. How's it going?
It is going good. I see I'm being patted on the head.
Yeah, this is going to be good. I'm going to provide you all kinds of affection. you can't really do too much about it. I'm sorry, but...
We did some fun karaoke recently, and there was a lot of affection there. So
that's right.
Great team bonding.
Good songs sang, beers drank. But enough about that. Enough about our New York excursion, our little retreat this past week. Really glad to be talking to you guys about some cool topics today. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing. So Divinity 2, top of that list, alongside Dishonored. Talk a little bit about Quake Champions as well. We're kind of in this... A little bit of a lull ahead of the major, capital M major, release season, yeah. I guess.
It's hard to call it a lull, but
yeah,
there's
only
coming.
Like a couple of major games a week right now ahead of the 4 or 5 a week we're going to have October and September, November. But we also want to dig into the changes to Steam's reviews and review bombing as a practice. Is review bombing a problem? What should Valve do about it? What are developers owed in terms of a system in Steam, and how does it affect you? I think we're going to dig into all that good stuff.
Fun.
And of course, as always, we'll be taking your questions at the end of the show here on Twitch, or if you're listening via the podcast, we'll get to hear some listener questions as well. Mm-hmm. But as always, we love to give our PC Gamer Club members priority. If you're, we were in an airport yesterday, so it's sort of like the special lane for questions that the Diamond Plus Mega Ultra Platinum card member holders.
We should send out cards.
10,000 miles edition. I love the classism of modern airports. I think it's really fun. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we love to give our club members priority. So hang out with us in Discord. Leave us questions in the Ask PC Gamer channel of the Discord server, and we'll definitely come around to them on the show. So yeah, as always, want to kick things off talking about what we've been playing. And James, I know you've been talking with some rats in addition to us this
That's
week.
That's true.
Having some conversations with Vermin.
Yeah.
And I want to hear all about this Dishonored standalone. Is it just called a standalone?
Yeah. Expansion? It's not even, there's no two at the end of it.
Yeah.
Dishonored Death of the Outsider.
Wow.
Which surprised me. Many typos were had on my end. So Dishonored Death of the Outsider is kind of, consider it an epilogue. You can read our review at pcgamer.com/reviews, and it's a pretty favorable review from Phil Savage. It's a standalone game. I think it's $30, might be $40. Don't quote me on that. And it's this short stint as Billy Lurk. I'm spacing her new name, Megan, I think.
Strong name for a stealth game character, by the way.
Very strong name. And it's not... It would be easy to classify it as more Dishonored, but there are enough changes going on that it feels unique. Chief among them is that Billy has new powers, and these new powers change how you kind of approach certain scenarios, and the scenarios themselves are kind of feel a bit more cordoned off and almost Hitman-like. So first to the powers, you have... Three, and you're limited to three. You're not getting new abilities as you go on. So you're kind of expected to lean into your gadgets a bit more. There's this new gadget, forgetting what it's called, but it's basically like you throw it on the ground, and if anyone comes within a certain range of it, it'll just whip them up and like, almost like a, what are those snare traps that you from a tree branch and pull them to the ceiling and they dangle by their feet and they get knocked unconscious.
Interesting. So you're not sort of inheriting the roster of abilities from Dishonored 2.
No.
Like, those are completely cut off to you because you're not sort of imbued with the same power as Billy. Yeah,
there are some abilities that kind of function the same way. Okay. Instead of a, you know, Emily had a dash or sort of a teleport move, and so did Corvo. Billy's is really interesting to me because you place a marker, basically. So you look at a place, you place a marker, and as long as that marker is in line of sight, and it can go pretty far, you can transport to it. So the difference is, the example they give you in the game right away is that there's a fence in front of you, and you can see through the fence, right? So if you get to a high point and place the marker, then you can, from behind the fence, as long as you can see the marker, teleport through it. So essentially through walls is one way to think about it. Certain walls in certain like smaller spaces that you couldn't do before. And that's really interesting in combination with another ability, which is essentially like a free floating, like free cam wall hack. So you teleport into this kind of ghost form and you can just fly around until your magic juice runs out. And you can mark enemies, you can mark items, you can mark your own traps and other traps. And then once you return to your body, that you will see them like through walls. So you'll see not just guards, but their vision cones and the path they're going to walk. In combination with the ability to kind of like plot your movement in a really like interesting ways. I think it feels like a slower, more tactical kind of way to approach stealth in that game. You can really like think a few steps ahead as opposed to it's harder to sort of improvise on the go. And some of the scenarios, well, the third ability is probably my favorite. Any unconscious person you knock unconscious, you can, it's really cool. She basically throws magic at their face. It's weird void magic and then like sucks their face off and you become that person. Like almost like Hitman.
It's very Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
as well.
It's pretty rad. You're sort of tethered to that person because as you walk, it's not based on a timer. So it's only as you move, your energy will drain. There are some like, I forget what they're, bone charms that let you extend like that reach. But it's interesting because, you know, now there are certain hallways or certain doors or certain like security checks that only certain people can go through. And you can basically assume their identity. I don't think it ever goes quite as deep as Hitman. People don't react to you.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be amazing if you could use that, parlay that into like having unique conversations with characters.
Exactly. And that's what I was hoping it did more of.
Yeah. It's not that diegetic. It's
no.
It's like a fancy key card.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly.
But very cool.
It's a stylish thing. I enjoy quite a bit.
Okay.
Those abilities in combination with sort of this, you have this kind of big hub world. You're basically plotting a bank heist, which is tight. I've yet to do the bank heist.
This
but
all
I hear
sounds
it's good.
I mean, like, okay, so I stopped playing Dishonored 2. Yeah. I found it sort of not too challenging, but like fussy in that like the guards are very smart.
Yeah.
I wasn't playing out in low difficulty. Like I wanted a challenge, but I don't know. I don't like having to run and hide, and I felt like I just had to kill stuff to get out of so many situations. And I wanted a game that was more martial, less magical.
I think this one might do.
And this sounds like that.
Yeah. You get more gadgets. Those like traps are really cool. And a huge change is that there's no consumable for refilling your magic meter. Mm. It just autofills. So that in combination with, you know, like your free floating camera ability and your like that really cool kind of tactical movement ability, it feels like it's letting you plan ahead and like giving you free reign to do that. And there's a contract system in this game. So it gives you a ton of sort of mini missions and there's these pockets and different spaces within this kind of overworld, this larger map that almost give you like Hitman style contracts. And I keep bringing up Hitman because it feels a lot more like a Hitman game. For instance, there's a bar. Well, you'll have to kidnap the bartender. You can't kill him. The bar is full of people and patrons, and you can walk freely around. And if you do a certain thing, you can walk freely around just like, you know, a Hitman game might allow you to. And so how are you going to do that in plain sight of everyone? You one option is just kill everyone except the guard, but I don't know, maybe that's not your style if you're going for a stealth playthrough. So, you know, using your, you know, who are you going to lure out? Maybe you just lure a guard out and distract the hitman bartender in a specific way and bring him upstairs and then take him out a window. There are these small pockets that ask you of these contracts ask you to do things in really specific ways that I dig a lot, and I've spent maybe, I don't know, 10 hours in the game already. Trying to do those in fun ways. So
sounds good.
Yeah. Highly recommended, especially I think if you bounced off Dishonored 2, this might be a bit more up your alley.
So all right.
Digging it a lot.
You just described me. Great. So it's Dishonored, not 2, but just Dishonored, Death of the Outsider. James, looking forward to more tales of talking to rats.
Oh yeah, you can talk to rats. That's the other cool thing. Anyway, talk to the rats.
It's definitely a bullet point on the box. Tyler, what about you, buddy?
Well, I was playing a ton of Absolver because it rules, despite its many, many problems. It actually just got an update today that I haven't been able to check out yet. But also, I've been playing Divinity Original Sin 2, which I don't know if you wanted to talk about that later or now, James.
I figure we just do it now. Why don't we just go into it now?
Yeah.
It's real good, you guys. It's real good and fun. The character creation, I spent probably 30 minutes in it, even though you don't have like a ton of like visual options. It's kind of just face, skin color, hairstyle. Mm-hmm. Although I do appreciate if you choose an undead character, you have bone color options. So you can have like sun bleached or, you know, that kind of thing. It's you can choose an instrument as well. Your character has an instrument that sort of themes their journey for whatever reason. I haven't really encountered
instrument as in like musical instrument, like literally gives you a theme,
like a cello.
Okay. So my impression of Divinity, help me sort of like understand Divinity in the context of other RPGs and fantasy games, right? Because, you know, I followed this game since the original, but I didn't play it. I heard a lot about Tom playing it and other folks in our team. Mm-hmm. And my impression of it is like, this is one of the weirdest, like intentionally and deeply weirdest fantasy games, you know, turn-based RPGs that just embraces every kind of esoteric thing it can. And if it makes the game really kind of uneven and asymmetrical, like, so what? Mm-hmm. You feel like that's an accurate impression, or is that kind of overblown?
I guess that's somewhat accurate. I mean, the combat can be weird. I think what you're probably remembering are like places where it was exploited, because they do stuff like having, you know, physical elements interact with each other, right? Where if you catch on fire, you can have one party member cast a spell to make it rain, to put that out. But it might also put out your opponents. I think in the first Original Sin, you know, one of the stories everyone told was someone who just put all their skill points into telekinesis or something to the point that they could just drop, you know, a 5,000 ton object that they made by like stacking backpacks or whatever it was to like kill the final boss. I think that was probably the favorite story from that game. I don't know what kind of exploitative mechanical sort of things people are going to find in this game. Well,
okay, so for example, like, I don't know how far you are in, Tyler, but I keep reading about this cat that follows you at the beginning of the game. And this seems like a good example of they've intentionally put this like really small but significant weird thing in the game that has implications beyond what it seems. So like, how does the game open, and what's the significance of this weird cat?
Right. So the game opens, you're on a ship. You are someone who has the ability to use Source, which is a really dangerous magic that has a habit of bringing evil creatures to life that kill everyone. So sorcerers, it's spelled S-O-U-R-C-E.
I was going to make a Source engine joke there about Half-Life, but keep going.
Are basically imprisoned a collar is put around their neck that prevents them from using the danger source magic, and they are taken to an island where they supposedly are living until a cure is found, but no one's really sure what's happening to them ultimately if they're taken away from the island. So you're on this boat, and it starts out kind of in a very planescape torment sort of way, where you wake up on this like operation table sort of, and you don't know where you are.
Just like Quake 4. Kind of, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So you have to walk around and interrogate people sort of and find out, you know, what's going on. You sort of have a vague memory. And that's also where you meet all of your potential companions. They're all with you on this ship. They've all been captured as well. They have different reasons for going to the island. Maybe some of them were captured on purpose. Maybe some of them have, you know, a personal mission or a vendetta. And when you start the game, you can actually choose to have one of those characters' backstories, and all the ones you don't choose will appear as NPCs, and you will be the one that you do choose. You can still customize their class, their right. appearance, all that. So I didn't do that at first, and then I started the game over and did that because someone told me, Fraser, our reviewer who's reviewing it now, said, actually, you really should. It's fun. And I would agree, because you get special dialogue options that relate to your backstory. So anyway, point is, there's a, you know, potentially evil, we're not sure, unclear motivations person on the boat, sorcerer, who breaks free of her collar, and you know, there's a giant beast comes, and you kind of have to learn the basics of combat, and you all wash up on shore on this prison, and from there, it's
hold on. That's like two beginning of an RPG cliches rolled into one.
You wash
up on shore into a prison.
Well, it's basically like a
prison. No, yes or no, Tyler. You wash up on shore and you're in a prison.
It's more of a. It's not a like bars. There is a dungeon, mm-hmm. but it's sort of like you're in exile and you've been taken to this place.
Path of Exile. You wash up on shore at the beginning. I'm sorry. I'm just poking at tropes here. Keep going.
I mean, it happens.
It does continue to be very like Planescape or Path of Exile, and that from there you're just kind of in the world now, figure out what to do. I mean, it becomes pretty clear to you pretty quickly, okay, I need to escape the prison section. Obviously, it's an RPG. There's other parts of the world to explore, but how you do that, you know, is up to you. It depends on who you talk to and whose advice you follow. Who you add to your party. There's one guy who'll run up to you, because you can have a party of four total, so including yourself. But one guy will run up to you, like right when you get there, if you encounter him, and say, I'm planning an escape. Do you want to come with me, just you and me? So, you know, I don't really know what would happen if I had taken that option. I wanted to build a full party, but you can play with just one other character potentially. And there's a perk you can add when you level up that makes you more powerful when you only have one other person in your party. So yeah, the amount of it that you can ignore, the number of, like, there's one character I didn't like off the outset who I just, the second time playing through, I didn't even talk to him because I knew he wasn't going to come with me. But yeah, so in the process of arriving at this island, wandering around and meeting people, a black cat starts following you. If you there's also a perk that lets you talk to animals, which means you know, if you don't have it, you just miss out on talking to animals entirely. So I thought, like, since I took that perk, I'm like, the cat is going to tell me something amazing. But then it just goes like, I'm confused. Where am I? And it just follows you around. So my understanding is that the cat can die. But I do not know what significance it holds later if you keep it around. It almost seems like the gnome, the idea of like carrying the gnome through an entire, what is it?
Left 4 Dead.
Yeah. It seems kind of like that. Like, here's this optional challenge. You know, I don't know what the hit points on the black cat are, but probably not very high. So it almost seems like, yeah, like a pro challenge. Can you keep the cat alive? I do not know what story relevance it may have. I wouldn't say if I did, because that'd probably be a big spoiler. Mm-hmm. But I do love that there is a cat.
Final thoughts. I do love that there is a cat.
Final thoughts. I also, I found a crab just randomly and started talking to it, and it was like, ew, gross human. You're disgusting. And it was really full of himself.
And I kind of wonder, because I bounced off the first game, maybe because I started in co-op and it became this like kind of slow, wandery thing without real direction. Some people will like that, but it seems like that it is almost absurd at every opportunity that I don't know. Does it feel like it loses the drive and like the narrative drive, and the character sort of gets lost in all the jokes and in all the wacky things happening? Or is that just sort of the point, is the delight in finding these things?
I wouldn't say it's been extremely wacky so far.
Maybe that's all I just hear about. Yeah.
It hasn't been like wackier than something like Planescape, which is to be fair, that's fairly wacky at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have like a talking floating skull hanging out with you, hitting on undead zombie workers when you start. But yeah, it hasn't felt like extremely wacky to me. Like the characters have backstories that aren't jokes, you know. Wait, right. One's out for revenge and one is scheming to maybe steal some stuff and escape, you know. It's not all just constant goofs. There's some like goofy kind of fantasy trope characters. There's also some really brutal stuff. Like you can, you know, in the very beginning of the game, you can encounter a guy having an argument with another guy, you know, and the one guy keeps talking about his wife who apparently died and is saying like, I think she's probably better off. You know what I'm saying? And the guy goes, say that again. And then he does. And the guy stabs him in the neck and kills him.
Damn.
Right there. You can sort of choose to be like, I would have done the same thing. Or you can accuse him of being a murderer. You can get into fights with anyone through that kind of system.
Oh, damn.
So it is super open-ended. I mean, you could try to wipe out the town if you wanted to. But the combat is very difficult, even on... I'm playing on the... I think it's called Classic. It's like the second difficulty level up from the easiest, and it's like you have to quick save a lot because it's not forgiving. Like if a character dies in battle and you don't have a resurrection scroll, even if you finish the battle and you win, you now need to go, you know, pawn your shirt to buy one because they'll just stay there dead. unless you save scum, which I admit I've been doing a lot. Because you're really not supposed to die. You're supposed to flee from battles you can't win and try to come back later.
Yeah.
You figured it out. But it even makes fleeing pretty hard. Characters have to flee individually. Your whole party doesn't run away at once. So if one of your characters is in trouble, you have to use your other characters to get them out of trouble and move them away from the enemy so they can flee. So, yeah, it I think it... I probably shouldn't save scum as much as I do. I'm going to try not to going forward. I'm just going to play a lot more carefully, but that means taking a lot longer to get through it. So I do think it could stall a little bit if I don't feel like I'm progressing through the story because I'm taking forever to talk to everyone and, you know, carefully try to min-max my party. But I'm kind of up for the challenge because I like the world. It's really beautiful and it is really fun when combat goes right because unexpected things do happen. You know, blowing up an oil barrel that maybe I didn't notice and that, you know, causing a ton of damage I didn't expect or, you know, whatever the case is.
Yeah, one of our club members, Apollo Dingo, I don't really know much about the depth of the combat system because I never got to that point in the first game and I've only heard whispers of it for the second one. But he was in chat just talking about how he was trying to make a spell that would rain blood and create a blood surface. So the fact that there's a condition in the world that creates a blood surface and that a blood surface has its own properties, that's a good sign to me. That's a good sign to me.
Yeah, blood. So for example, if someone is standing on blood, I could freeze that blood with a spell and there's a chance that they might fall over basically and get knocked, that they might slip on the ice. Also, for instance, I have a ability I can use that I cast it on a character. They'll soak up all the blood puddles around them and gain health.
Oh, right.
Because I'm like a very creepy cleric, basically. There's also a passive ability that just lets you gain health if you're standing in blood. Mm-hmm. So they put all the sort of status effects and materials to to work as much as they can. So that is good, because you would, if it were just kind of like in some instances, a wet surface might do something a little differently. If it were inconsistent at all, mm-hmm. I think it would be annoying to me. But the fact that everything kind of works how you expect it, if you electrocute a water puddle, it'll electrocute anyone standing in it, which definitely makes collateral damage a real problem. It's very easy to set your own party members on fire. I have accidentally caused a ton of self-damage playing this game. So, but just, I think they treat the design of this game the way a DM might treat running a D&D campaign, in that I think that anytime they think of something that you should be able to do, they seem to try to put it in. They can't do everything right, but there's stuff like, I haven't tried this myself, but I'm told if you have an undead character in your party, they are bones, and so they are able to pick locks with their bony fingers. So they don't need lock picks. So that kind of thing a player might ask a DM, like, oh, could I try to pick it with my bony finger? You know,
yeah.
They've thought of that and put that in, which I really enjoy, that just the thoroughness. It's just kind of brute force game design almost.
Yeah.
Ask questions, try to answer them with every system.
Trying to be encyclopedic. I mean, it's the Scribblenauts approach to to making a game or something. Yeah, because in a lot of ways, that approach doesn't necessarily result in fun, right? It's in opposition to being leaner and tighter and, you know, less is more elegance in game design, where, you know, there are three paths, but they all have this really nice relationship with one another. They're all meaningful. They're all really built out. They have nice contrast. But also in Divinity, there's a cat who, if you keep it alive, it has all these implications or something, right?
I love it.
So I don't know. I feel like, I guess the fun there is the entertainment value of discovering in the moment, like the designers and the authors of this thing went through the trouble of, you know, making it really deep and complex and putting all this detail, and certainly people from like a pen and paper background will appreciate that, I think.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's already sold 500,000 copies in a week. Divinity.
Yeah.
I think it's very warranted, even though, again, I played a certain amount, restarted it, and then had to go to New York. So I'm by no means an expert on the game, but we will have a review coming from Mr. Fraser Brown
tomorrow.
Look forward to it.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Very cool. Well, I want to talk about Quake Champions.
I'm not surprised. The shooter king. He's
I'm more of a prince or duke. I don't know if I
feudal wanna... lord of
feudal
shooters.
Lord of, yeah. Baron. I'll take any of those titles. So yeah, Quake Champions has been out for, came out on the 22nd of August, I guess, in early access, both on Bethesda's platform, the Bethesda Launcher, is that what they're calling it these days?
Yes, or maybe Bethesda.net Launcher.
I love to launch Bethesda.
Launching good.
Love it. And it's also on Steam. It's $30 and you get all the characters if you pay that much, but it will be free in the future?
Yeah, that's the intent.
Yeah, so it's sort of paid early access, but it'll be free. Interesting approach. Yeah, man. So my feelings on Quake are contradictory and complex, and they've gone back and forth and they've evolved. And I feel like I haven't had that relationship with a game in some time, where I feel one way at the beginning and one way in the middle and one way another week, you know, another day, another hour even. And I know you guys have all been playing. I want you to let me know if that reflects how you've been feeling too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's this big monolithic shooter that has class-based, you know, character-based moves now. And that's scary and different to me. So I go back and forth on that stuff constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause on paper, and we heard a lot of this concern when the game was announced at E3 2016, on paper, Quake Champions is abandoning the values of Quake.
Yeah.
In fundamental ways. You know, it has asymmetrical characters for the first time, essentially, in the multiplayer version of the game's history. Mm-hmm. Right? So variable health totals, variable armor totals, passive abilities, active abilities that I wouldn't call them ultimates. They're not quite ultimate.
You're not going to wipe a team with them,
no.
Typically.
And they have cooldowns. And but, you know, really, really tampering with some of the core aspects of what makes Quake Quake, right? Because if you think about Quake, it's all about purity. Mm-hmm. It's all about you and me, who's better, who can get to that mega health faster, who can get to that quad damage, who's better at the railgun in a showdown at high speed. You know, it's like the F1 racing of shooters for me, you know, and it's about that purity. And in order to have that kind of game, there needs to be sort of, it needs to be regulated in a certain way. It needs to sort of be controlled where, you know, there aren't these kind of abilities and power-ups accessible to certain people. It's a level playing field, right? That's part of it. And what id and Saber Interactive, the other studio working on the game, have done is, you know, they've it's like putting hit points on chess pieces or something, you know, like to a Quake player, to someone who's been playing this game for now 20 years, you know, Quake 1, 1996. Yeah, it's like putting hit points on the queen and the knight on the chessboard.
Yeah, right? What if we did put hit points on the chess pieces?
Right. Queens now take two hits.
Let me tell you about chess 2, which I think is actually a thing.
I think it is a thing.
So at first I was really grappling with those differences, right? So at first I was like, I'm in these duels, right? If you play Quake, you know what it's like to be in a rocket duel with somebody. You both got a similar weapon, or they've got a lightning gun, you've got a rocket launcher, and you have a sense of the back and forth, right? You have a sense of like who's ahead and who's behind. I've gotten like a good hit and like a half of a good hit on somebody, and this guy's like done maybe 50% lightning gun damage to me. I have a sense of where the battle is. And then suddenly they'll activate their ultimate ability, or their ability, whatever it is, their active ability, and spit acid on me.
What?
And now I've take this like unexpected damage and I'm gone, right? And it's sort of like, well, shit, that's not what Quake is about. What just happened? That feels totally unfair. And like this interrupted our duel, this new system, this new design, like, oh, this is ridiculous. And then I started playing with them more, and I started having those same, like having those experiences on the other end. So the character I probably played the most, there's about 9 of them, I think.
I think so, yeah.
He's called Scalebearer. And Scalebearer is big, hulking, you know, mythical soldier looking dude.
Yeah, cool outfit.
The characters are all different sizes too. They have different hitboxes. Yeah. They have different movement styles, I should mention. But Scalebearer, his ability is he has this kind of rhino-like forward dash with a little bit of turning ability, mm-hmm. Although it's limited. And if he plows into you, he'll do X amount of damage. And if he kills you, he can even carry that forward and run into multiple enemies.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
So you yeah. can like in one dash, perhaps I've done a couple times, like right. kill two people. Yeah. It'll do like maybe 50 damage or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. So I started getting these kills, right? I'd be in these duels and I'd be like, shoot, they're vulnerable. They're up against a wall. I can just ram into them and kill them instantly. And it was like, oh, that felt great. And now I'm like, oh, I like these abilities because of course they're working for me.
Right.
And I feel like my perspective on it has evolved to an extent where like, yes, this game is not as pure as Quake 3. You know, there are a number of things that kind of undermine that and work against that. It's fundamentally a different type of game, but the core experience of trying to like building up your stack as like a Quake player would say, you know, getting your armor and health up as high as possible so that you're ready to engage. That's something you do. You like navigating the map as quickly as possible, swiftly as possible, thinking about when, you know, when the mega health is up, when the armor is up again, so you can get there first and be able to have that big advantage in terms of hit points. That's still completely preserved. Mm-hmm. Managing your weapons, completely preserved. Managing lines of sight on the map and sort of, you know, forming like a patrol path and anticipating your enemy's movements. That's all totally in place. And I think they do a good job in terms of sound design and some other right. stuff to enhance that. You know, the abilities, they have these moments of friction still for me where I'm fighting somebody and they disappear and they're invulnerable and I can't shoot
characters.
Them. And then they appear behind me and they kill me.
Yeah.
But I think once you kind of accept those asymmetries, you sort of start to appreciate, or at least I have, that this is simply a different style of Quake game. And it's not one that, I don't know, it still fundamentally resembles Quake. It walks and talks like Quake. Maybe it doesn't sound like Quake, but it's still, for me, about Quake movement and Quake maps with Quake weapons. That's all there.
Right.
That's well preserved. But you have this kind of layer of asymmetry on top of it that makes those dances a little more off kilter, you know, for an experienced FPS player, for an experienced Quake player. You have to say like, oh, they might have their ability ready. That cooldown might have expired already. So I have to sort of account for this guy spitting acid on me, or this guy being able to wall hack for 10 seconds, or being able to disappear, or put up a temporary shield in front of them. Right. Mm. And I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
I have not played nearly as much Quake or Quake Champions as you, but I it's a game that I have decades of experience with, I think. Gosh. Ugh. And I think the growing pain for me, and I'm calling it a growing pain right now, because I enjoy, like you said, as scale bearer.
Yeah.
The feeling of seeing an opportunity and knowing your ability and it clicking and you pulling it off and say, okay, in this tactical situation, I did this right thing and I was rewarded. That feels great. And that's like still to me what kind of Quake is about. It's split second decision making. And these abilities are new, you know, it's a new vocabulary for Quake players, sure. And it may be hard to introduce to people who've been playing this game for decades, far more often than myself. But once they are sort of internalized, I think, and once, you know, there's a sense of understanding when it comes to which character has what kind of hitbox in their health pool, and you know, once the meta is internalized, I think it still, like you said, boils down to the same things, you know, these quick encounters, you know, running the map for your armor and health and power-ups, and in a split second choosing the right thing to do and executing it with precision. And the asymmetry is there, but we've been playing the same Quake for so long. We can still play the same Quake.
Yeah, and Quake Live is still out there for the folks who want that. It, you know, it's Quake 3 or nothing kind of experience. Mm-hmm. For me, Quake Champions really exemplifies something that many developers have grappled with, which is how do you take a big popular franchise with decades of history and meaning and the way things should be, right? Counter-Strike's another huge example of this. You have this built-up expectation for what is sacred in that game. Dust 2 looks like this. The AK-47 shoots like this. The AWP has these kind of behaviors. It costs this much. You have to do all those things. You can't tamper with that because that is the DNA of Counter-Strike. You can't mess with the DNA. Otherwise, that's not Counter-Strike, right? But it's interesting, you know, the way that developers find ways to kind of bend the lines. You know, when CSGO first came out in 2012, oh my God.
What?
So long ago. Crazy.
I don't think you really liked it when it came out, did you?
It didn't have flinch animations. That's one thing I remember talking about in my review. That was wild. But a big deal was made about they were changing the routes on some of these classic maps. DE Dust, not Dust 2, had like a whole other corridor on the left side toward B. That you could sort of get out of this tunnel that was famously like a big bottleneck for snipers. And it shook things up in a meaningful way, right? It got people out of the behaviors and the same sort of patterns of, okay, I'm going to spawn, go here and prepare for these finite sets of scenarios that I've encountered for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it got people out of their comfort zones. I think TF2 has a long history of doing that too. So with Quake Champions, I honestly appreciate that. There's so many bad roads they could have gone down with this game, and maybe they did, and they had to do that in order to get here, right? First of all, it's not a multi-platform game. I think we have to appreciate that. You know, if you're talking about what would compromise Quake the most, it's probably being on PlayStation, and being on PC as well. I don't, you know, when they announced it, they said that they had no plans to bring it to console. I think that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't, but it doesn't, I don't know how they would do it. I don't know how that game would be playable on a gamepad. And for me, what the game does so successfully, and this is kind of where I've ended up with Quake Champions, is it's like a living museum for Quake, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of a best case scenario. That's kind of what I've come to appreciate most about it. You know, yes, it's got microtransactions. Yes, it's got crazy, ludicrous cosmetic bullshit in the game that you have to deal with. Three kinds of currency, three kinds of loot boxes. We talked about it last time on the show. I'm not going to harp on it too much more, but it's sort of an interesting preservation of the entire franchise. And what I mean by that is, so what this asymmetry and the different character types allow is they've sort of ingrained these different styles that have existed across the entire history of a Quake, mm-hmm. right? So different movement styles, from just pure bunny hopping to strafe jumping to, you know, just all those different movement styles, and sort of given them their own character to some extent, all the little variations. There's even one that behaves like Unreal Tournament, which of course is an Unreal game, where, you know, in UT 2K4, you could, if you remember, you could double tap in a direction to sort of side dash. You could do that, you know, forward, left, backer to the sides. So like the big robotic character Clutch can do that as well. So it's kind of a nice nod to the arena shooter genre as a whole. And that wouldn't be possible if this game was just, there's one character and you have a skin, everybody's the same, everybody works the same. And it's sort of a nice way of paying homage to itself and preserving that, but also making it interesting, where you sort of identify the people you're fighting against by their own history with that game, right? So you sort of see the person doing this kind of movement style and you say, oh, that's a Quake 3 player. Or you see someone doing it this way and you say, that's a Quake 4 player. Who's that? How'd you get here? why do you like that game? And I think that's really cool. You know, it's really an interesting philosophy, an interesting way of approaching things. It's sort of paying homage to yourself, but doing it in a really explicit way that provides player choice.
Yeah, I agree. It's a nice clean package that. I can see it being a platform for a long time coming, with playlists that enable and promote, you know, specific play styles. If you want to play original Quake, or if you want to play Quake 3 style, or whatever it may be. So I don't know. I'm excited to see like how they use it in that way. I did have a question from Buttface Jones. If you want to address this. He asked earlier in the PC Gamer Club Discord chat, Quake Champions currently has no mod support, and there have been indications from Bethesda that no mod support is coming. Between loot box economies and attempts to keep cheaters out of the game, do you think competitive shooters like Quake, Overwatch, or future titles will ever have mod support? And I mean, that's sort of a compromise in sort of how, you know, in this game's strengths, it may be. It takes away from sort of the, I guess, the PC origins it used to have and strengths it used to have in mod support. Do you see that as like a huge loss? Or do you think they could enable that in the future in some fashion?
You definitely feel its absence, you know?
Yeah.
Quake and modding are inseparable. Mm-hmm. You know, the original Quake started in a lot of ways modding as we know it. Although obviously people were messing with shareware games and all that sort of thing long before, but really formalized like sharing maps and stuff like that as a process and people making their own versions on this very moddable engine. And it's sad to not have that be the case with Quake, you know, a game that really presents that as value across its lifespan. However, you know, there are ways they could integrate it. We've seen some really successful examples of that in games like Team Fortress 2, right? So you could have modders create maps and then they sort of become part of this, maps or other stuff, cosmetic gear. They become part of this like community marketplace, of course, just like Team Fortress 2 or Dota or a lot of other games where people are making cosmetic stuff or even playable stuff. And the developer like puts a stamp on it, makes it a part of a collection, and you can like pay to support it, or you vote or whatever. There's a lot of mechanisms available there. And of course, Bethesda has its Creation Club now, which
yeah.
doesn't do revenue sharing as we understand it, but sort of pays modders a flat fee for the right to sell their mod. Of course, Bethesda wouldn't tell you that it's paid mods, strangely. I think that's a possibility. If modding came to Quake Champions, it would have to be through the Creation Club. I don't know why Bethesda wouldn't use that as an opportunity. Yeah. But, you know, if you want a game that's doing it the complete opposite way, but it's still an arena shooter that released in 1999, it's kind of amazing that you have that option. Go play Unreal Tournament, because that's a game being made by modders with the help of Epic, you know, like deep collaboration. So that's cool available to you. Yeah.
Tyler, are you good at Quake Champions yet?
No.
Are you going to get good at Quake Champions? You think you'll
be very bad? I tried to emulate this guy who was just skating around as what is he at? Anarch something.
Anarchy? The skull guitar skateboarder guy. Yeah.
And then he was just doing that with like the gauntlet and just kept freaking gauntleting me. Is that a verb? And then when I thought he would have that and I would stay back from him, he would have the damn lightning gun and then just destroy me. So and I did a little better. I think I just have to emulate people who are good. I think when you start, that's really the only way. But no, I suck. I get maybe like 10 kills a game.
Yeah.
Evan, I'm sure you're up there with 50.
No, I had a 30 in one match when I was playing with
God damn.
Our friend Lucas. What? That was really good. That felt crazy. Like, anyway.
Wild. I mean, that's my biggest problem with the game right now, or personal problem maybe, is that my experience playing Quake was almost exclusively LAN parties. So there might have been an outlier where someone was excellent at the game, but we were all sort of like playing at the same pace. And in its current state, I think it's enthusiasts in there. And I'm getting my ass handed to me a lot. But when it opens up to being free to play, I think matchmaking will probably, you know, sort of level out a bit. And I'll I won't die as often. But I also am just, I don't know, I've lost the touch a little bit. This fucking Overwatch lets me just like point in a general direction and click. So
we've been spoiled.
Yeah.
You don't have that same level of can't just sort of decide to play Lucio for a match and passively help people. No. You have to fight and contribute. But blessing and the curse of that style of game. The skill cap is so high. You know, there's these people doing insane maneuvers. You know, if you can put your cursor on somebody at 100 miles an hour, you can hit them, you know, that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. But of course, being on the other side of that doesn't always feel good. So yeah, on the matchmaking topic, one of the best features of the game is the ability to select from a bunch of different, all different server regions from the main menu. So you can decide, well, okay, I want to queue into US East and West and the UK and Australia or something. You know, that's like the pool of players that I want to be paired with. And it shows you individually your pings to each of those servers. Amazing feature. Every multiplayer game should have that.
I agree. So often.
Obviously, we'd love to have just servers. I think that's cool too. But, you know, you can't beat matchmaking for just the expediency of getting into a match from scratch.
Definitely not.
So, yeah, I think this is a game I'm going to continue to put a lot of hours into. I think FPS players should be excited about it. I'm a little surprised there's not more enthusiasm before. I think that's simply sort of, again, the saturation of games and new stuff every week. We had a Dishonored game. We had a, you know, Divinity sequel that's already sold 500,000 copies in a week.
A lot more coming in the weeks to come. It's going to be crazy. But I think, once it goes free to play, it'll find a steady following for sure. I'm excited.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
All right, so let's dive into an easier topic here related to Steam itself, and that is Steam reviews, the changes Valve are making to them.
Yeah, so...
And Steam review bombing.
Yes.
As a despicable behavior, or one that at least Valve has identified as a problem. We've seen some interesting instances of this recently. So if you happen to miss it yesterday, you can, of course, find some good authoritative stuff on PCGamer.com. talking about this topic, Valve announced some major changes to reviews, or maybe not major enough. I feel like it's probably better described as like they kind of lifted the skirt, they opened the curtain on, we've been grappling with this issue and figuring out what to do about it, and here's what we came up with.
Yeah, so they came up with the idea to introduce histograms, basically. So charting the how reviews are, you know, what kind of reviews, positive, negative. I don't know all of the, like, highly recommended or overwhelmingly negative, and, you know, on charts that graph it from its release to the present day. And so you can see not just what kind of reception it's getting, but how many of those reviews are coming in a certain amount of time. And this is a response to, obviously, this, you know, the review bombing of Firewatch over the controversy sort of surrounding PewDiePie and his racist remark, and the response of Camposanto to say, well, we don't watch, you know, we're filing a DMCA and taking our videos down that involve Firewatch with you.
Yeah, it's interesting just to trace that path. I mean, when you put it that way, this is a gross oversimplification, but
yes,
PewDiePie, you know, a man in Sweden says the N-word, and Valve makes a change to the way reviews are visualized on its website for 130 million Steam accounts or whatever it is. Interesting times, interesting hobby we have. So Tyler, I know you've been digging into this. You're working on a story right now. I think, can you sort of give us an overview of what Valve talked about in its blog post yesterday and what changes have been made exactly?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Valve talks about review bombing in kind of an equivocating way, which I think really speaks to their philosophy when it comes to this kind of thing. Because, you know, it says, in the post, on one hand, players doing the bombing are fulfilling the goal of user reviews, which, as Valve puts it, is to voice their opinion as to why other people shouldn't buy the game. On the other hand, the reason they're doing review bombing might not be relevant to the game itself. It might be some beef they have with the publishers, politics, or whatever. But then Valve goes back again and says, but some of them are real reasons why a player might be unhappy with their purchase. So I'm basically not convinced Valve does consider it a problem, quote unquote, to solve. The way it's responded is by giving us more data, by showing us when it's happening and saying, now you can see that there's a suspicious number of negative reviews in a short period of time. You can maybe go find out why that is, and you might find out it's something you don't care about. You might find it's something you do care about. But to a degree, Valve doesn't want to tell anyone what a legitimate reason to leave a review is or isn't. And this has been its philosophy ever since it started with Greenlight. It stopped wanting to tell people what is or isn't a game that can go on Valve, and it likewise doesn't want to tell anyone what is or isn't a reason to post a review. So instead of solving it, it just wants to expose the data and hope the market sort of figures it out, right? Yeah. Or balances itself.
Completely. And is that not inconsistent with many aspects of Steam that we've seen over the past decade, from Steam Greenlight to Steam Direct most recently, right?
Yep.
To their policy on sex games or games with sexual...
I was going to bring that up too.
Games with sexual content,
the reason
right?
that's so confusing
is
because they don't, like, when they're pushed far enough, they'll make a judgment on something and say, that's too sexy. But they don't want to give a really explicit, clear reason because they almost want to pretend like they aren't making a judgment, it feels like, to me.
Yeah, it's an unwillingness to make a moral judgment. And I'm really curious how long that's going to last. You know, whatever you have to say about Apple, and certainly they've had weird instances of taking down games with content that they object to, you know, whether it's like a historical game with a Confederate flag or you know, that kind of equivalent. You know, they do act on those instances, you know, rightly or wrongly, like they seem fairly engaged And you could say it's inconsistent, but they're at least sort of targeting those games, it seems like, and have more of a careful eye over their marketplace. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Valve seems very unwilling to pass a moral judgment on the stuff that it...
No.
Across Steam, right? Whether it's comments, reviews, games...
Yeah, I mean, they hand the people a wrench and say, you can make something with this, or you can bash people over the head with this. And in some ways, I see that as like an optimistic decision. We would imagine or hope that people, our users, you know, come to the mutual conclusion that this is a good thing for everyone, and work together to... keep it a place that, you know, provides accurate data. But I think the issue here is that, I mean, like, what review system is not exploited or bombed at some point?
Yes.
You can point to, I don't know, Metacritic's user reviews. You can point to Amazon. You can point to just about literally anything. And I don't know. It seems to be a cultural thing. Some kind of platform for the people to maybe not actually educate people about making buying decisions, but about their personal beliefs. And what do you do about that? How do you respond to that besides gutting it completely? Do you guys know of a system out there that has responded to this stuff well or done something?
Well, one of the issues, I think, is that Valve doesn't want to essentially pick a politics or an ideology, because what is something abhorrent that someone could do that you think might justify a review bombing? Is there anything? Was Campo Santo justified in sending a DMCA to PewDiePie because he said a racial slur? They don't want to have to do a like both sides do it kind of rhetoric. They just want to not touch anyone, right? That way they can say, look, we didn't pick and choose what was okay and what wasn't. I don't know how you solve it with that philosophy. The only way I think to solve it would be to moderate it, but to moderate it is to choose a set of values that you are going to make everyone adhere to, and pronounce those. I certainly don't think Valve wants to do that. It's very big. It has a lot of different people who go to it. A lot of people with very different opinions on what is and isn't okay use it. Ultimately, it doesn't want to alienate any one of those groups, right? So it can't write down a big, you know, policy guide saying what it allows and what it doesn't.
And we have to remember, too, that a lot of this stems from this deeply embedded unstated value within Valve to not be a large company.
Yeah.
So Valve is bigger than it's ever been right now in terms of just the number of folks that work for the company. We think it's around somewhere like 330 at the most. And they're working on these VR games that are still unannounced. They're working on Dota, obviously. They're working on Artifact,
right,
the Dota card game. Maintaining TF2, Steam Workshop, the Steam platform itself, the Source Engine. There's a lot of stuff going on, a ton of stuff going on for that many people. You might even hazard to say that that is the fewest number of people working on the most things in the industry. I know that sounds insane because there's this whole meme of Valve doesn't make games and Valve isn't doing anything. What are they doing? Guys, they're making games. They're making three VR games, three full VR games as they refer to it. They're making a card game. They make Dota. They make Counter-Strike. They make two of the biggest games in the world, just those alone. And then you've got TF2, you got their legacy games, whatever. You've got mods, Steam. It's a lot, all right, for that many people. But Gabe Newell, where did he used to work? He worked at Microsoft for 13 years, all right? He left Microsoft to make an independent studio. He doesn't want to grow to the size of a Microsoft. He doesn't want to see his company become or even start to kind of resemble halfway something like a Microsoft and have investors or anything like that. Like, Valve could have done that. It could have scaled up. It could have become a public company at any point over the past 10 years. And they've resisted that over and over and over again. Even as they add new people, encounter new challenges. So I think a lot of it stems from that, right? Like every problem has to be resolved in the most elegant and automated way possible. That is a deeply ingrained value. And I think you saw this a lot with in an AMA, I don't know, it was like March or January even, where, you know, you got a lot of publicity where Gabe admitted how poor Steam support was and all like the issues that they encounter there and how their response times weren't great. And they responded by what? By saying that they do better and by putting up a graph, another piece of visual information, you know, quantifiable information on their site that tracks like the response times to what, refund requests or support tickets?
Yes.
I forget. So again, it's, you know, quantifying versus qualifying. There's a big preference for numbers rather than words. And, you know, tackling massive scale problems with individual people or dozens of people rather than hundreds of people.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wonder where the line is for Valve, because it feels irresponsible to me to create such a large amorphous kind of marketplace where that the majority, oh God, we lost Tyler. The majority of, PC, well, a lot of PC gamers, you know, refer to as the place to buy games, maybe unhealthily, but, I wonder, like, it feels like managing a public pool with a spreadsheet rather than lifeguards. And
wow,
that worries me.
That's pretty good.
Right. You know, it feels like they desperately need a human touch in some of these far reaching corners of their, you know, storefront.
And, certainly.
And that worries me. How efficient can they be?
Right. Right. There's this idea that it sort of, it might change the identity of the company if they buckle down and hired 100 people to do a moderation or support or something, right? It's against their values. And in a way that's admirable, like really sticking to the core identity of who they are and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'll keep talking here if you want to try and summon Tyler back into our conversation. There, that's weird.
Whoa.
Mirror Universe, you and me talking on the podcast. So something I think one of my initial reactions to this news, right, was, okay, so super admirable that Valve, you know, not the most historically transparent company. They've had moments of transparency that have been really good. And, you know, they've been getting better at it with the AMAs they did. They invited us to a big roundtable conversation earlier this year up in their studio. So I think it's something they're getting better at communication. But, you know, super admirable on the surface that they published this long, you know, 1,000+ word blog showing their sort of what seemed like a months or weeks of history of grappling with the issue, what to do. We thought about this, but that wouldn't work for this reason. And I think they really did a good job of shedding the light on their perspective. I think that deserves praise. Where they ended up though, is they, you know, they identified review bombing as a problem. They said that twice explicitly in the first three paragraphs. They say review bombing is a problem. And, you know, they don't want to take down the review score. You know, they don't want to eliminate or like cancel out like false reviews, mm-hmm. because they say that there are instances where, you know, groups of people get together and rally against a developer that are maybe more like addressing something in the game as opposed to something outside of the game. But where they end up is, yeah, this histogram, this graph, I don't know if we could pull it up to show, but,
sure. Yeah.
You know, it's essentially a timeline of the positive and negative volume of reviews over time. And to me, if I'm somebody who either encourages or wants to engage in this behavior, and to be clear, like, I don't think it's a good consumer practice for anybody to, you know, basically like fraudulently review something. I don't like that. As someone who reviews games, of course, I don't like that. But they created like a permanent record essentially of the sentiment for a game.
Right.
And I think that's dangerous. I think, you know, we can argue about whether review bombing actually has a material impact on sales. That's something that we like actually Valve disputes in its blog, which is very interesting. They claim that, you know, we found they don't really provide hard evidence, but their conclusion was that, you know, review bombing doesn't seem to have like a very big material impact. But I think now that it's visualized and it's quantified and you have this really nice source of feedback as a review bomber, this encourages me to organize, because I can see the dent that I'm making in this vehicle, as opposed to just bashing away blindly, right? It's I see it happening over time. I see the change happening, and that's very rewarding. Somebody said on Twitter, it's like Valve didn't understand that gamers like to see numbers get bigger. You know,
it's true.
I think we do.
And, we all do.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. Okay, here's one of the things I predict, right? Over the past year or so, with the growth of services like Steam Spy and with just concurrency numbers becoming kind of a bigger currency, I guess, within gaming, we've seen a lot with Lawbreakers recently, right? Where people hold up, oh, Lawbreakers has X hundred concurrent players, therefore it's a failure and, you know, no one should play it, and let's like dance in the grave and make people feel bad, even though it's a good game. You're going to see people taking screen captures of these graphs and cropping them and sharing them on Twitter, sharing them their message boards, putting them on Reddit and sort of saying, ha, look how mad we all are. Look how successful it is. And like, look at all the red. First, there was a lot of blue, and now there's a lot of red. We did it. We did it, guys. Like, it's working. Yeah. And, you know, there's not going to be any, I guess Steam Spy can help show like how it's affecting sales over time, hypothetically. But you're going to see these graphs used as ammunition in online arguments and rhetoric, and for better or worse, I don't know. But I guarantee that's going to happen, and I'm not looking forward to having those kind of debates with folks.
Walking simulators aren't games. Look at this Gone Home review dip in, you know, from last year. I told you that's maybe a light example, but absolutely, I can see
right. But it's this idea that like these graphs represent truth.
They
represent sort of like the global sentiment of happiness and anger. You know, those two things, like fighting a war of like good and bad. Is a game good or bad? Now it's bad. Look, you know, it's all there. Just look, it's bad now.
It's, you're essentially quantifying like angry Twitter or forum posts and making it, like you say, truth.
Yeah.
Visible to everybody.
Yeah.
Presented as such.
And I don't know if we've articulated this, so it's not just the graph. Right. What Valve is doing is you're going to be able to sort of look at the reviews specific to a time on that timeline. So say like, you know, there's a big positive spike on, you know, the day after Christmas, because a lot of people got this game and they're really excited to talk about it or whatever, or right after release. And you can like go to those reviews and just read those and sort of look at that pocket of time and examine that. I think that's a really cool feature, but I think it's unfortunate that that's sort of their ultimate answer right now for how to go about this, right? They're saying, well, we're going to give players sort of a better system to examine all the reviews and understand for themselves why this dip or spike occurred. I think that's putting a big expectation on players. And I'm not saying like people aren't smart enough or anything like that. I'm thinking it just requires a level of depth and analysis and like time to dig in there and say like, okay, I'm going to read reviews from 6 months ago and then, you know, yesterday and compare them and like really sort of, okay, I'm going to look at how many hours these people played and like put a piece, like a picture together in my mind of why this all occurred. And like, I don't know, like being, I don't know, like we could just tell you that in an article. We do that every day, all day, every day. Like why games are changing and like how one update affected people, like with qualitative information, we can really contextualize that. I think that's a better tool as a writer. Yeah. Of course, I'm going to say that, but expecting the audience, you know, to go into that level of digging, that amount of digging and work to understand a game. I think some people are really into that. I think a lot of folks who want to browse Steam and are sort of immersed in the fact that Steam is going to release between 6,000 and 7,000 games this year. Holy shit. You know, that's another job for them before making a buying decision.
2 years from now, I don't trust myself to understand why, you know, offhand, why Firewatch got a review dip. Maybe because I work at PC Gamer, but the average person who opens up Steam, sees a game in their discovery queue and says, what does this dip represent? How the fuck are they supposed to know?
And how are they supposed to sort of connect the dots that like, okay, say, okay, No Man's Sky, for example, looking back that game's a year old or so now. Wow. Are those reviews, do we expect those reviews to be honest about the issues that the game faced? Do we expect some of them to exaggerate and be sort of, you know, like memey and, you know, I would say probably I would want to dig back in there and look at, honestly, as an exercise. But I don't know. It's asking a lot of the average Steam user.
Yeah. I'm curious. At the very least, I'm curious to see what happens with this and then how, again, Valve responds, because I think this is a problem that is far from over.
Yeah.
And will continue on for as long as Valve, you know, can iterate on it.
And we should say that they don't identify this as their final solution something.
No,
they openly admit in the blog, and I think, again, giving them their due praise that, you know, this issue may, I think they say, require some additional work in the future.
It just might.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true. If we look at the history of Greenlight and all those sorts of sub-services within Steam, you know, things are always subject to change, and I hope they do in this case.
Tyler.
But Evan, isn't it at least a little bit funny sometimes when a big account posts a Twitter poll and it's obvious what answer they want, and then everyone just bombs it with the other answer? I mean, it can definitely be funny when someone does something stupid or has a bad opinion and people make a fool of them on the internet using graphs and charts and lines. And I totally agree. Sorry I cut out there. We're going to see it used in a really negative, annoying way to decide what games are good and what games are bad. But I think there's going to be at least one that's pretty funny. And I look forward to that one.
That's all we can hope for.
That sounds good. All right. So we'll continue to tackle this issue on our site. It's something we'll be writing about soon. And hat tip to Tyler for the work you're doing so far on that. But
I'm not going to write that it's going to be funny. That was just a podcast only comment.
and let us know as we transition into Q&A in a moment here if you have any more specific questions on this topic. Yeah. If there's something you guys want us to cover that we perhaps didn't. Before we do Q&A, I want to dive into another article Tyler wrote recently, which is hey, it's almost the end of September, but there's a lot of interesting games coming still.
So many.
In fact, there are at least 99 noteworthy PC games still on the way this year, and Tyler collected all of those.
There were more too.
There were more.
I couldn't even hit. I mean, I actually added two after publishing it. So technically it's 101 now, but I liked 99. I'm sorry that the headline became a lie.
It's all right, Tyler.
But there are even more than that. There's so many.
All right. So you can find this on our site from last week, but most recently I'll just rattle them off. We had Tooth and Tail. We had Divinity Original Sin 2, which we talked about. Dishonored, NBA 2K18, still one of the only sports games, 3D sports games on PC. And just yesterday, we had Marvel versus Capcom Infinite. But in addition to that, want to give a chance to let you guys shout out a couple of these games that are coming out before the end of the year that you're excited about. For me, it would have been BattleTech, but that got delayed.
Dang.
BattleTech definitely would have been at the top of the list for me.
Is there anything else?
No, that's it.
That's it.
All my feelings are gone. No, I'm sure I've got a few more here. I think like a lot of folks, I'm looking forward to Wolfenstein: The New Colossus, Wolfenstein 2, excuse me.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a big one.
I think, you know, it's just sort of crazy to think about Bethesda is making some of the best campaign first-person games right now. I don't know really who's doing that better.
Yeah,
over the past three or four years,
it feels risky. In today's,
between Bethesda and Doom, and Prey, you know, like,
but
quietly, that's like their reputation in a lot of ways. What they do.
And I think I admire that. I suppose it's mm-hmm. it's something I desperately love in PC gaming and sort of miss as a popular thing to make. But excited for Wolfenstein.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have more on that soon.
Yeah, you got a chance to play it. I won't spoil what you saw because I think it's still under embargo, but it sounded pretty crazy.
I'm very excited.
And you compared what you played to a certain, like, slightly obscure 90s cartoon.
I did.
Which I thought was very fun. Okay, I'm just teasing the audience at this point. I'm sorry. What about, like, Assassin's Creed? Is anybody excited about that? Is that going to be a thing?
You know, I've played it about 2 hours of the... No, three at this point of Assassin's Creed Origins, And I'm not an Assassin's Creed guy. After two, I was so burnt out on the ideas. Hmm. But Origins, in my last preview, it was easy to see the inspiration from The Witcher 3 in almost every corner of that game. And with an emphasis on storytelling and questing and loot and a huge, like, the world, I'm sure it's leaked online, but we were not allowed to show the full map. Is massive, like massive map. If they can kind of insert interesting stories to tell, because I don't think that's been a strength of Assassin's Creed in the past, and interesting places to explore. They have some tombs, and I got to go inside of a pyramid. The inside of a pyramid was a little disappointing because it was like a bad physics puzzle. This will be, at least for a lot of people, maybe not for people who are not convinced or sold on the series to begin with. This could be like the return, the grand return.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
All right. So Tyler, out of those 99 games that you scooped up, put Ooh. Into a page, which are you looking forward to most?
It's a lot of games. Let me look through here. This is one I think you're probably into, Evan. Dusk.
Yeah.
Dusk. Yeah.
I played the first chapter of that.
Quake. Yeah. You go.
Oh yeah, I mean it's basically what Heretic, Hexen, and Doom kind of all rolled together, and a little bit of Quake. It's Heretic against hillbillies. So a lot of, you know, very sort of hashtag 90s features mm-hmm. in this game, like built into the settings menu.
Yeah, popular thing to do today is to throw back a single player shooter for sure.
I'm a sucker for that. I mean, I'm the target audience for that kind of shit.
Yeah.
A slider that determines how pixelated I want my 3D early 1996. You're seeing it right there, actually.
Right. I mean, Evan, you and I are the same age, and people our age are making games, and that's clearly what's happening, right? But that's good for us.
Yeah, I found Dusk to be kind of simple. I wanted more enemy variety, and I hope we'll get that as these chapters roll out over time. But like the aesthetic, you know, like the speed, and obviously I want more games with this kind of movement style after the release of Strafe early this year.
Yeah, and worth noting, we found out that the soundtrack is by the guy who did the Brutal Doom soundtrack.
So, oh, nice.
Excellent music in that game.
Good.
If you buy it now, you can get access to episode one, so if you're into that thing. I want to talk about, real quickly, Ruiner. Have you guys heard of Ruiner?
Yeah.
It's
September 26th is going to be out.
Yeah, pretty soon. So this is a cool Devolver Digital published cyberpunk kind of Hotline Miami inspired, you might say,
mm-hmm.
game. I have the final version, but I can't really comment on it. I can say from the demos I played that it's easy to consider it to go in thinking it will play exactly like a Hotline Miami because it has that perspective and sort of a lot of the same visual language. You know, you have a crowbar and guns and so on, but you have this teleport move that you're seeing
there
right
it
now
is.
Changes how you play completely. So you can basically plot out several dashes in a row, and it slows down time as you do it.
It's a lot like Tracer in Overwatch. You have three dashes you can make, and it recharges over time.
Right. So I kind of wanted to go in and just like dodge enemy fire and you know, warp around the map like mad, but that wasn't quite working, and shoot them with guns. I was dying a lot. When I slowed down and, you know, kind of plotted my course and, like, you know, had these small bursts of action, almost like playing football or something, you know, you set up a play, execute it, take stock of like, oh, there's new enemies coming to the screen. How do I want to like dash around this, you know, new arrangement and take these guys out? It was really thrilling and tactically satisfying in a way that I did not expect from that game. Also, banging soundtrack, like dripping with style. So pretty.
Is it very Blade Runner-y in its soundtrack as it is in its visual design?
Blade Runner-y, but it's like Blade Runner goes to the club, you know. It's got some of those bleak that bleak droney stuff, but it's also got some heavy crunchy bass.
All right.
It's, you know, a lot of fun.
Well, gosh. Those are but a few of the games releasing before the end of the year. I think we will continue to talk about them and the ones that we find most interesting on this show, on our website, on Twitter, everywhere that we are. Let's dig into your questions, though, because hopefully you guys are ready to talk about some of those games as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as always, we love to take viewer listener questions here on Twitch every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific as we do the PC Gamer show. But you can find us in our Discord channel. If you're a PC Gamer Club member, you can go over to club.pcgamer.com and get premier gold, platinum, double
first
deluxe
class access.
Yeah.
We have stewards and stewardesses that will come to you and deliver your PC games on a tray.
That's right. Your questions will be walked up a special carpet. Yeah.
Do be sure to tag us in chat if you're going to ask us a question right now. Otherwise, I will gloss over it. So do that. We do have some saved up. One, we addressed Buttface Jones questions already. Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah, but we've got a question here from Truzen.
Truzen.
Thanks a lot, Truzen. It says, what particular game series must be played in order to be fully appreciated, and which ones can you just jump in at any point? So he's sort of saying, okay, in order to sort of like really wrap your head around and understand the full value of mm-hmm. something, like what you have to play from beginning to end versus what can you kind of jump into? That's interesting.
I was brainstorming answers for this, but it kind of struck me that most sequels try to encapsulate or at least like give players, you know, the history lesson right up front and teach them mm-hmm. everything they need to know. So it was really hard for me to come up with anything that people had to play from the beginning to truly understand that hasn't been streamlined in sequels or something, unless they want the story. But as far as things that I made a quick bullet point list of a few things that you can hop into at any point, like the Nier series. You don't need to play Drakengard 1 or 2 and Nier to play Nier Automata. Or, I don't know. I wanted to ask you, Tyler, Divinity 2, did you play the first one very much?
I did, but I wouldn't say very much. I definitely didn't beat it. I definitely don't remember what it was about at this point. But 2 is definitely a self-contained sort of adventure.
Right.
It's the good kind of, in my opinion, video game premise, where it's like straight to the point. There's some bad magic. You're on a boat. You're a prisoner.
Go.
We don't know what the bad magic does yet, but let's find out, you know.
Right.
Or we know what it does, but we don't know why. So, yeah, that's kind of my favorite video game setup. I hate it when there's an 18-minute cutscene to start a video game. Like, just give me a cool world and build it out from there. Okay. That said, I would be upset if someone said they played Mass Effect 2 without having played 1, like,
of course.
Because
how could I forget?
Those three games for me represent, you know, something I carried through over years that had meaning to me, going from one to the next, meeting characters. But that's partially because I was waiting years between them and I was excited to continue that story and meet those characters again. So I don't know, you can probably just find not to play Mass Effect 1 if you don't want to.
I think so.
But I would be sad that you did skip it.
As much fun to play anymore.
I find that game grueling.
No.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
I find it grueling. I think the Citadel is, it's like a JRPG hub from the 90s.
Holy shit.
You spend like at least 20 hours just in the Citadel.
Yeah, it's
pretty cool. Yeah, but it's a cool space station.
I'm not down.
There's praying mantises cool. on computers.
There are.
Yeah, well, that's a tough one. I think we'll have to think about that and really come up with. Evan, is there like anything that pops to mind for you?
Really quickly, you know, I just think about multiplayer shooters like TF2. TF2 is about to have its 10-year anniversary in October. Mm-hmm. And think about the fact that you can't really, okay, there are like modded servers and stuff where you can play like vanilla versions of TF2 that take out certain items and stuff like that, but it's not the same in terms of balance and experiencing like what the game was like at launch in terms of the weapons that were available, the maps that were available, and seeing the progression from now it's free to play, you know, now it has this item marketplace, now there's entirely different modes. Mm-hmm. Now the demo man doesn't just launch grenades, he has a claymore, you know, Scottish short sword and shield, and he can dash forward. Now the engineer can be offensive as well as defensive. Like, experiencing the history of that game and the changes over time, it's actually like really sad to me in a way that you can't kind of go back to these little pockets and chapters of that game's history and experience them anymore. You know, they're not accessible to you. And I think in order to appreciate a game like TF2, you you have to, you know, you have to sort of have participated in a good amount of that history.
Right. We just lost the stream. We might be back now. We're still recording, so don't sweat.
Oh, cool. No big deal.
I don't know what's going on. Yeah. We'll still keep answering your questions. We're back in live. Okay, cool. We're fine. Sorry about that, guys. Not sure what happened. Just a weird hiccup. Let's ask a few more questions.
Yeah.
And I lost JBJ Blazes, but he subscribed for resubscribed for 21 months, which is pretty impressive. And not word for word, but have you guys ever competed against or played a game with a parent or your mother? Because his mother's celebrating a birthday, so he brought that up.
Yeah, I think one of the early games I played with my dad when we had like a 486 or Pentium 2, probably not. I don't know. Anyway, like the Wing Commander series, I remember getting that on CD-ROM and having all the discs. And like I would play it one night, my dad would play it the next night. We sort of like trade stories and talk about where we were in the campaign and what issues we were having. Joystick taking up too much desk space in the 90s. That and like the early adventure games, Myst and the King's Quest series, I think in the same way, like, you know, trading story. I remember buying like a weird little guidebook for Myst for how to get through stuff and my dad looking through it and from Best Buy or something.
Tyler?
I was always playing games with my mom.
Oh, really?
She loved Prince of Persia. We played Myst together. We played a lot of adventure games together too because it's easy for two people to kind of sit and solve puzzles like The Seventh Guest and The 11th Hour. Did I get both of those? Was it The 13th Hour? We played those. Then we got an SNES and we played a ton of Super Metroid and all the Donkey Kong Country games.
Damn, your parents are nerds.
It goes on and on. Yeah, my dad and I would play Command and Conquer Red Alert LAN matches with him down in the kitchen, me up in my bedroom, just screaming at each other.
That is a cool dad.
That is a very
a dad, dad that builds Tesla coils is a cool dad.
I think he still plays Civ, but that's probably about it.
Oh man, I got nothing. My parents aren't very computer or video game literate, but my mom and I definitely play a lot of Free Cell or Solitaire or Mancala together on the PC. So
nice.
Good. The hard, you know, the hits, the oldies.
For sure.
Let's see. We got time for probably like one more. I'll ask Jedi Smurf 99. It's a good name. I think that's a good name. Do you guys know what any old guard PCG guys are up to these days? Like the Veed. I don't know some of these off the top of my head, but is there like can you kind of roll us through what people are up to?
Oh boy. Yeah, they're around. So I've been here for 9 years at PC Gamer since 2008, and I've had a chance to work with a lot of these folks. Our buddy Dan Morris, former editor, and I believe he was publisher at one point. He's working at Oculus, but I think he might be at Facebook. But working on Oculus.
Right.
Kristen Salvatore, person who hired me, my former boss. She was working at EA for a while. Now she's working at Twitch. Cool. So right here in San Francisco with us. Those folks just down the street. And let's see. The Veed, he was also working at Twitch for a time. Before that, he worked at Hewlett Packard when they were like interested in gaming briefly. Now he's working at a company called Improbable, which is right now they're in this like big financing phase and they're releasing all these press releases like we got millions of dollars to make this like 1,000 person survival game in like the next few years.
Damn.
And so they're like working on some like very ambitious platforms for big multiplayer platforms, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah, that looks interesting. Other folks, I don't know. Corey Banks, former managing editor, works at EA. I don't know. There's other folks I'm suggesting
was
forgetting.
I'm seeing in Twitter, was Josh Augustine a PC Gamer guy?
Yeah.
He recently put out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So our buddy Josh, former, I think he was briefly an intern, but anyway, Josh works at Blizzard now. That's pretty cool. And he just published his first, I don't know, it was a quest, but content for World of Warcraft.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Pretty amazing. Like lifelong dream of Josh Augustine. Yeah. He was formerly working at EverQuest at Sony Online. So like, man, a lot of people doing interesting stuff that have walked through our door. I think that's like a cool part of our heritage and something to celebrate. So What's that?
Writing his, I said there's Gary Whitta, of course, too, writing his screenplays.
Gary Whitta writes Star Wars movies now. That's fine.
Hell.
And other stuff. He's working on, was it Mouse Guard or Red Wall? I don't know.
Mouse Guard, yes.
Both the same thing.
And Tom Francis is releasing his second game sometime soon. It's very soon. Heat Signature. So up to a lot of good stuff, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you work at PC Gamer, you go on to do amazing things. Right on.
I'll probably start a farm, the PC farm, and brand my cattle with.
That sounds good.
Yeah. EA and Ubisoft logos. I think that's about it for questions.
Oh, somebody wants to know if I'm finished. The answer is yes.
Well, hell, yeah.
Thanks.
Spotted it.
Not like 100% or anything. That would be crazy. I recently learned my favorite foreign word in Finnish, which is the Finnish word for ice cream cone.
Which is?
It's jatele tetra.
What?
It has a lot. Can you share it? Just type in Finnish word for ice cream cone. I know this has nothing to do with games, guys, but like, I just want to share this word for you because it's kind of incredible. It has an incredible, it has the most umlauts I've ever seen. That's saying something for Scandinavian languages. Jatele tetra. If anybody's Finnish in our...
That's a toughie.
In our comments, they should, in our chat here, they should let me know if I'm pronouncing that wrong. I thought it was fun to say.
That is a toughie.
Sounds like a good appropriate word for ice cream cone. Anyway, on that note, on that delicious note, Tyler, James, thanks for joining us on this journey, talking about Steam reviews, Divinity, Quick Champions, and a whole lot more. It's going to be a fun end of the year, guys. We got some great games around the corner. I'm looking forward to tackling these topics with you and you guys in chat and over on our Discord server where you can always find us. It's basically the hangout for our community, for our most loyal readers, as well as our team. Like our whole staff is in our Discord server, so we'd love to have you there. If you feel like joining the PC Gamer Club over at club.pcgamer.com, we give away free games and exclusive beta access. Let's see, just in the past month, we've given away access to Destiny beta, The Amazing Eternals, which is the new hero shooter, I guess, from
the Warframe developers.
From the developers of Warframe. Yeah. Yep, very, very cool. And let's see.
Gave out some random copies of the, I'm forgetting the name, the Monster Hunter game, killed the monsters. Dauntless. The Dauntless beta, which is fairly expensive. So, for that early access, so you might just show up one day with a bunch of free games.
Yeah, and it's a good place to, you know, we like to think that our community is a set of really nice people that we like to play games with, and we like to connect our community members with other folks who are looking to play games. We've got channels for that, so hope you'll join us on there. We'd love to see you so we can continue our passionate conversations about games. But thanks a lot for watching and listening. Again, this has been the PC Gamer Show. Find us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock Pacific or 4 PM Eastern.
That's new.
I don't know what the time zone is right now. It's +7 or +8 in GMT.
Yeah.
I'm not good at tracking that stuff week to week. But yeah. Thanks for joining us, guys, and we'll see you again next week. Get your questions ready for then. Thanks for watching.
Bye.